Welcome back. I'm in my extensive library, as you can see here, my NEI library. And we're going to be doing a topic now that's of considerable importance, clinically relevant, and a very common issue, one that gets a lot of questions whenever we do presentations on this topic. And there's been some recent new developments, including a new medication approved to treat postpartum depression, as well as one in development. So the title of our talk is Maternal Mental Health, Addressing Peri and Postpartum Depression. You can see my disclosures here as always. And don't forget to answer the pretest questions. If you go over to the panel on the right side, you'll see Q&A and you'll see polls. You want to go to the polls. And so let's get started. Our objectives here are to implement evidence-based strategies to manage depression during pregnancy and after pregnancy, counsel patients about the risks versus benefits of medication treatment during pregnancy and postpartum, and compare the safety profiles of treatment options for depression during the postpartum period. First, we're going to talk about depression during pregnancy, and then we'll talk about postpartum. As far as epidemiology of mood disorders during pregnancy, the prevalence rates are high. First trimester, 7.4%. Second trimester goes up to 12.8% and then stays kind of stable in the third trimester at 12%. When we talk specifically about bipolar disorder, and I was always trained that postpartum depression is a marker for bipolar, but during pregnancy, 5.1% of women at an OB clinic who were pregnant met criteria for bipolar disorder, and 12% of women referred to a women's mental health program for psychiatric assessment during pregnancy. So obviously this is a higher risk than the general population, which is only about 1% for bipolar disorder, 1 to 3%. Prevalence of anxiety disorders and OCD is also high during pregnancy. Now, there are many concerns here when we're talking about the benefit versus risk of treating. So we have this Venn diagram where there's an overlap of some of the issues. On the left, we have untreated depression during pregnancy, and on the right, we have the risks for antidepressants. Untreated depression is associated with inadequate maternal weight gain, poor maternal self-care, substance use, preeclampsia, even medical conditions, impaired fetal-placental function, fetal distress, more C-sections, neonatal care unit admittance, and postpartum depression. As far as antidepressants, there's a question here. Do we really know? What about the risk of cardiac defects with antidepressants, autism, PPH, major cardiac malformations, postnatal adaptation syndrome? And then there's overlap in some of the concerns between the two. Miscarriage, preterm birth, low birth weight, small for gestational age, and long-term neurodevelopmental abnormalities. So this is really a difficult balancing act that we have to undergo here. So let's first zoom in on the risks of untreated depression in pregnancy. The effect on child development. We know that children who are born to mothers who've been depressed during pregnancy have higher impulsivity, maladaptive social interactions, cognitive, behavioral, and emotional difficulties, including things like ADHD and depression. Maternal complications, pregnancy complications like eclampsia, postpartum depression, safety concerns in hospitalization, engagement in higher risk behaviors like smoking, alcohol, and illicit drug use, and poor nutrition, and then increased risk of suicide, sadly. As far as screening, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, my father was an OBGYN, you'd think I'd know how to say the word, ACOG, recommends women should be screened for depression and anxiety symptoms at least once during the perinatal period. So at least once during the perinatal period. As far as clinical management during pregnancy, for women who are currently taking medication for depression, psychiatrically stable women who prefer to stay on the medication may be able to do so after consultation to discuss risks and benefits. And I'm going to get into some of those risks and some of the myths around some of these risks. Antidepressants, to cut to the chase, are probably safer than we may have been led to believe in the past. Women who'd like to discontinue medication may attempt tapering depending on their current status and psychiatric history. Now, women with current symptoms despite their medication or recurrent depression may benefit from psychotherapy to replace or augment their medication. So don't forget about that. And then as far as women that you really want to keep on the medication, the risk factors are women with severe depression, including suicide attempts, functional incapacitation, or weight loss, 7 to 9 depressive symptoms, so 7 to 9 out of the 9 potential depression symptoms from DSM. Those who score greater than or equal to 20 on the PHQ-9, which indicates severe level of depression, they should all stay on medication or be counseled to stay on medication. They're at highest risk. If the patient refuses medication, alternative treatment and monitoring should be in place, preferably before discontinuation. Now, quick word again about bipolar. If you have a pregnant woman who is depressed and it's not responding to antidepressants, remember to reevaluate the diagnosis and to consider bipolar disorder, which, of course, standard antidepressants may not be as effective for. As far as women not currently taking medication, psychotherapy, of course, may be beneficial. For women who prefer taking medication, risks and benefits of treatment choices should be evaluated and discussed, including factors like the stage of gestation. Obviously, first trimester is the highest risk. What kinds of symptoms they're having, prior history of depression. Women who've had prior history of depression are a greater risk, and other conditions or circumstances, such as someone who's smoking and you really want to try to get them to quit smoking. It's harder to do if your depression is untreated, and difficulty gaining weight, for instance, and of course, suicidality. Okay, how about SSRI use during pregnancy? Well, prevalence of SSRI use during pregnancy is 3 to 7%. That's fairly common. Recent findings and more data inform the pharmacologic treatment of depression during pregnancy. Consistent conclusions that the absolute risk of malformations with SSRI exposure in pregnancy is small. So the potential risk of untreated depression probably outweighs the risk of the antidepressant itself. Recent case control studies reveal inconsistent data regarding teratogenic risk of individual SSRIs. Reproductive safety data on SSRIs exceed what is known about most other medicines used during pregnancy. These have been some of the most extensively well studied. Here is a really important article that was published a few years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, of all places, called Antidepressant Use in Pregnancy and the Risk of Cardiac Deficits. This is an analysis of almost 1 million pregnant women who were enrolled in a Medicaid database, and they were followed from 3 months prior to pregnancy to 1 month following pregnancy. Almost 7% use of SSRIs in the first trimester, and many women don't realize they're even pregnant during the first trimester. There's no evidence of the take-home message, no evidence of increased risk for major malformations or cardiovascular malformations in children of pregnant women exposed to SSRIs. So again, no significant cardiovascular malformation risk or major malformation risk with SSRIs. And this is a very large study that was extensively peer-reviewed. How about the risk of autism? Well, there are two studies here we're going to look at, the Canadian study and the Swedish study. The Canadian study factored in a large number of potential confounding variables and compared exposed children with unexposed siblings, almost 36,000 singleton births. After factoring in propensity scores for confounding variables, the association with autism was not significant. Also not significant when exposed children were compared with unexposed siblings. In the Swedish study, controlling for pregnancy, maternal and paternal covariates, sibling comparisons, timing of exposure. This is a very large study looking at almost 1 million mothers and almost 1 million babies. And the first trimester exposure associated with a small increased risk of preterm birth, but no increased risk of small for gestational age, and no increased risk for autistic spectrum or ADHD, interestingly. So two studies that show no significant association with autism. Okay, here now is a meta-analysis looking at all of these many different studies. And what you would expect to see if you look at the graph on the right, at the plot on the right, if the boxes are to the left of the number one, that would favor an association of autism with SSRIs. You can see all of them are to the right of the vertical line or the number one, which means that there is not an associated risk. So there does not appear to be an associated risk of autism with SSRIs during pregnancy. How about late pregnancy and the risk of PPH, persistent pulmonary hypertension? Well, of almost 4 million pregnancies, 128,950 women, or 3.4%, filled at least one prescription for antidepressants during the last 90 days of pregnancy. The vast majority, 2.7%, were on an SSRI, and 0.7% were non-SSRI. 7,630 infants, or 20.8 per 10,000 births, not exposed to antidepressants, were diagnosed with PPHN. So you need to know that PPHN, or PPH, is something that is seen normally. 322 infants, or 31.5 per 10,000 births, were exposed to SSRIs, and 78 infants, or 29.1 out of 10,000 births, were exposed to non-SSRIs. So the absolute risks with an SSRI was about 0.3%, with no antidepressant was about 0.2%, so only a 0.1% difference. So I can't say there's no risk, and there are warnings about this, but the risk does appear to be fairly low, and again, has to be compared against the risks of untreated or inadequately treated depression and all the complications we talked about earlier. There are other interventions to consider besides antidepressant medications, besides pharmacologic treatment, and that includes TMS. Two open studies with large samples have been reported. Response rates of 41.4% to 70%, remission rates of 20.7% to 30%, and partial response 34.5%. So there is some evidence potentially. This is a question that needs to be better answered with sham-controlled studies, of course. Exercise, which we know has multiple benefits, and the benefits of exercise for treating depression are well established. And when we look specifically at exercise during pregnancy, the effect size for physical activity interventions during pregnancy and in the postpartum period was 0.41. That's actually higher than the effect size for some antidepressant studies, which are in the 0.3 range. So we're talking about a very clear efficacy of an intervention that's really easy to implement and certainly should be part of our counseling of our patients. As far as other things that could be looked at or thought about, folic acid, bright light therapy, massage, and acupuncture have been studied, but no really good rigorous studies. All right, let's talk now about the postpartum period and postpartum depression specifically. First, we have to distinguish between postpartum depression and baby blues. Baby blues are common, 75%. They resolve by day 10 postpartum. The symptoms you see here in the treatment, as far as postpartum depression, however, the prevalence is about 20%. The duration, minimum of 2 weeks, so it lasts longer. The symptoms for baby blues are mood lability, tearfulness, irritability, confusion, and fatigue. Whereas postpartum depression, the patient will meet full criteria for a major depressive episode in DSM-5. The treatment for baby blues is support, reassurance, and of course, paying attention to adequate sleep hygiene, which is difficult, of course, sometimes with a newborn. Postpartum depression, pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic treatments. All right, let's talk about GABA-A receptor modulation of the HPA axis. So you can see here, we've got the hippocampus ringing around the hypothalamus, connecting down to the pituitary. You can see in the hypothalamus, the GABA-A receptors, which are ion channel receptors. And you can see that the hypothalamus and hippocampus are inside the blood-brain barrier, whereas the pituitary sits just below the blood-brain barrier. And of course, the adrenal glands are sitting outside the blood-brain barrier. Now, when allopregnanolone and estrogen levels are normal, things are in homeostasis. But, and this is the normally what happens, you can see that corticotropin-releasing factors released from the hypothalamus. The pituitary then secretes corticotropin, or ACTH. That hits the adrenal gland, of course, and then we get cortisol released. Cortisol then feeds back up into the blood, into the brain, and binds to receptors on the hippocampus, cortisol receptors on the hippocampus. What happens now if we use GABA? So GABA is the major neurotransmitter here, the normal inhibitory neurotransmitter. So when GABA binds to GABA-A receptors, you can see here that we get a decrease in the cascade that ends up releasing cortisol. And so that is calming down the situation. That's a good thing. Now, what happens if we have too much allopregnanolone and estrogen levels? Allopregnanolone and estrogen levels are high. Well, we stimulate the placenta to release placenta corticotropin-releasing factor, or PCRF. This then stimulates the adrenal glands to release cortisol. And then the placenta also releases its own cortisol. And then we get a positive feedback loop where more placental corticotropin releasing factor comes out. And we now stimulate the hypothalamus to release CRF. So we've got a do loop going on here. And the pituitary squeezes out a lot of ACTH, and we get, unfortunately, a lot of cortisol release. And that can be toxic and can cause depression. So if the hormone system is out of balance here, you would get a lot more cortisol and more risk for depression. If we come in with GABA again, or a GABA-A receptor agonist, you can see that we calm the system down. Now, what happens if we have an acute stressor? An acute stressor now wipes out the placenta here, and we get the hypothalamus stimulated, and we get the whole cascade again, as you can see here, ending up with cortisol. So stress, obviously not good for the system, as we know. And there we go again. We're just going through the cycle one more time. All right. And there's cortisol. All right. Postpartum depression. It's the most common complication of childbirth, 10 to 20% of new mothers. Hang on. If I go back, I forgot to mention this. If I go back. So what we're talking about really here is a delicate balance modulating system. And one potential treatment here for postpartum depression is obviously stimulating those GABA-A receptors, which tone down the HPA axis and get less cortisol released. So we're going to remember that later when I talk about the new treatments for PPD. Okay, so postpartum depression is the most common complication of childbirth, 10 to 20% of new mothers. 40 to 80% of postpartum depression cases are considered moderate to severe. 25 to 40% with a prior history of depression will have PPD. So that's critically important in screening your pregnant women. If they have a prior history of depression, they're at higher risk and you need to watch them more carefully and counsel them. Onset during the postpartum period, 40%. Onset during the first 4 months postpartum in as many as 94% of cases. During pregnancy can be a quarter to a third. Maybe a recurrence of unipolar or bipolar depression episode occurring during or prior to pregnancy, so watch for that. About 40% of women with PPD will have a relapse during subsequent perinatal periods. So again, it's almost as if this system now, it's almost as if it's hypersensitized and each subsequent pregnancy will trigger the whole cascade again. Untreated postpartum depression is common, and the factors that lead to untreated postpartum depression are reluctance to seek help because of the guilt over feeling depressed during a period that society views as joyful. I should feel better. What's the matter here? The stigma, of course, of mental health treatment in general, reluctance to utilize medication during lactation, that's a legitimate concern, lack of screening, poor coordination of care, obviously people who have less resources. Risks. The risks of untreated postpartum depression include increased maternal morbidity and mortality, epigenetic changes to infant glucocorticoid receptor genes, so altered HPA axis reactivity that actually follows the child throughout their life. These epigenetic changes can then set this child up for depression, anxiety, and other problems throughout the rest of their life. Impaired child emotional and cognitive development and infant mortality. As far as the risk factors for postpartum depression, anxiety and depression during pregnancy can predict postpartum depression, a previous episode of PPD, a previous history of depression, as we've said, heightened HPA axis sensitivity to hormonal changes, unwanted pregnancy, which is very stressful, and then, of course, any other stressful life events during pregnancy or early postpartum, and low levels of social support, of course. As far as DSM-5 criteria, there's been a little bit of an evolution from DSM-4 to DSM-5. DSM-4, the specifier was with postnatal onset. So there actually is not a separate diagnostic category in DSM for postpartum depression. It's major depressive episode. In DSM-4, the specifier was with postnatal onset. In DSM-5, it's been changed to with peripartum onset. So onset during pregnancy or within 4 weeks postpartum, 4 weeks, which is a short period of time. So the issues are depression during pregnancy versus postpartum depression. Are they different things and do they require different treatment strategies? Onset, the argument that postpartum depression may occur anytime during the first year. So really cutting it off at 4 weeks seems a little short. And if you remember my earlier slide, I said 94% happened within the first 4 months. So probably we need to consider the postpartum period to be longer than just the 4 weeks that are in DSM-5. As far as screening, I mentioned this earlier, the U.S. Prevention Task Force Services and ACOG recommend screening for depression at least once during the postpartum period. Clinician overall impression of maternal health detects less than 30% of PPD cases, meaning that if you just ask clinicians without doing formal screening or using a rating scale, look for postpartum depression. Do you think there's postpartum depression? Less than 30% of the time do clinicians pick this up. So you really have to be vigilant and look for it, again, considering some of the risk factors we've talked about. There are two scales here that are commonly used. The EPDS, which is the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale. This is a 10-item Likert-style questionnaire. Takes only about 5 minutes to complete. The score of 10 plus deserves attention. Then there's the PDSS, the Postpartum Depression Screening Scale. This is a 35-item Likert-style questionnaire, takes about 5 to 10 minutes to complete. A score of 60 plus deserves attention. All right, what about antidepressants? First of all, how about using antidepressants to prevent postpartum depression? Unfortunately, the results are mixed. A Cochrane review concluded that antidepressants show modest benefit in preventing peripartum depression. However, insufficient data to recommend their use. Antidepressant use during the third trimester in euthymic women did not prevent postpartum depression for those who were at risk. About 10% of those taking antidepressants develop PPD versus 13% of those not taking the antidepressants. So really not much of a risk reduction there. As far as treating postpartum depression, the Cochrane review concluded there's insufficient evidence to say whether and for whom antidepressant or psychosocial treatments are more effective, although they really need to be implemented, of course. As far as the efficacy and safety of antidepressants for postpartum depression, several antidepressants, including SSRIs and the tricyclic nortriptyline, have shown efficacy for PPD. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality reports insufficient data for the efficacy of antidepressants for PPD, even though there are positive studies, but at least they say there's no evidence of harm to mothers or infants. Here's one particular study looking at sertraline, and you can see the response rate is over 60% versus placebo, where the response rate was just over 20%. So clearly, sertraline demonstrated very significant efficacy. Now, in this study, response rate was defined a little bit liberally as a score of less than or equal to 10 on the HAM-D. Typically, we use a score for remission of less than or equal to 7 on the HAM-D. This is response, so bar's a little higher, less than or equal to 10. Also, they have to have at least a 50% decrease on their Hamilton depression score and at least a much or very much improved score on the CGI, Clinical Global Impression Scale. So we do have evidence for antidepressants. Now, before initiating an antidepressant, screen all patients diagnosed with PPD for evidence of bipolar disorder. I can't emphasize this strongly enough. As a matter of fact, I was trained that severe or psychotic postpartum depression is bipolar disorder until proven otherwise. And of course, again, the treatment is different for bipolar depression versus unipolar depression. Our typical monoaminergic agents don't work as well if it's bipolar depression. You need to consider an atypical and a psychotic mood stabilizer, something with evidence for efficacy for bipolar depression. Antidepressants should be used with caution in antidepressant naive women who experience their first depressive episode in the postpartum period. Caution also needs to be exercised when using antidepressants in women who have mixed depression. So that's major depressive episode with mixed features, some mixed manic features. Those people, we're now learning, they may be bipolar spectrum, but what we do know now is those people need to be treated with atypical antipsychotics, especially the ones that have demonstrated antidepressant efficacy, and that would include lurasidone, cariprazine. The newer one, lumateperone, now has some positive data on bipolar depression, also quetiapine and the olanzapine-fluoxetine combination. Antidepressants should be tapered if the patient develops postpartum psychosis, and treatment should be carried out with initiation optimization again of a mood stabilizer or atypical antipsychotic with mood stabilizing properties. I like to call those atypical antipsychotics mood stabilizing antidepressants. Not all atypicals have shown antidepressant efficacy, by the way, and some clearly have more than others. So you want to use a mood stabilizing antidepressant atypical antipsychotic. And again, I mentioned some of those. Now, without going into too much detail on this busy slide, most studies of infant exposure to antidepressants show low levels of breast milk and infant serum. So we're talking now about breastfeeding with antidepressants. However, they do show levels in breast milk, and they do show some levels in the infant serum. So to be honest, even though if you look carefully through this table, some of these, it is said, can be used safely. My bias is to not breastfeed with antidepressants, if at all possible. I just don't like the concept that they're crossing into the infant. We just don't have enough evidence to know what are the long-term effects of antidepressant exposure early on. All right. Okay, I'm trying to move the slide. Let's see here. All right, Stephen, could you help me out and move the slide for me? For some reason, it stopped moving. There we go. Okay. There are certain situations, of course, with postpartum depression when antidepressants should be avoided or used cautiously. I've alluded to some of these already. That's major depressive episode with mixed features. That should say major depressive episode, by the way, with mixed features. There's no such thing as major depressive disorder with mixed features. A major depressive episode with first onset in the postpartum period. Major depressive episode with onset early in the postpartum. History of bipolar disorder in a first degree relative. Again, that puts the person at higher risk for bipolar disorder. And then atypical features such as hypersomnia, hyperphagia or increased appetite, increased sleep, and leaden paralysis. And the reason why is because that's a marker, again, for bipolar disorder. About 60% of the major depressive episodes that a bipolar patient will have are atypical episodes, and as high as 60% of their depressive episodes might also be with mixed features or a mixed depressive episode. So mixed depression, atypical depressions in the postpartum period, that's a really high risk patient for bipolar disorder, which needs to be treated again with a mood stabilizing antidepressant, atypical antipsychotic, such as I mentioned, lorazepam is FDA approved, quetiapine is FDA approved, olanzapine fluoxetine combination is FDA approved, cariprazine is now FDA approved. We also have lumateperone, the newest one that has positive data and may eventually get FDA approved. Okay, not moving. The slides are not moving. Thank you. Okay. How about mood stabilizers? When we say, see, it's funny because I have trouble with the term mood stabilizers because I include some of the atypical antipsychotics as mood stabilizers. But what we're using here is the traditional term of mood stabilizers, which is lithium and some of the anticonvulsants. So what about mood stabilizers in breastfeeding? Well, there's a considerable amount of lithium and lamotrigine excreted into breast milk. So again, my bias is to not breastfeed on those medications. There's less data on valproate and oxcarbazepine. However, the infant-maternal ratio of serum drug concentration seems to be lower in valproate exposure compared to other mood stabilizers. Again, it's not zero. I still am concerned about that risk. The incidence of adverse events in infants exposed to mood stabilizers has been reported to be low, but it's not zero. Mood stabilizers can be prescribed to most lactating women without adverse events in infants is what this review has said, but again, I'm just not a fan of that. Low prevalence rate of laboratory abnormalities, including hepatic, kidney, and thyroid functions, even with lithium in the infants. So you have to take that into account, I suppose. Now, there may be some situations where, look, this is a very brittle bipolar patient, and they are finally stabilized on a combination of medicines. And again, now evaluating the potential benefit versus the potential risk says, I want to keep them on the medicine, and the mother insists on breastfeeding. If there's a way to counsel the mother not to breastfeed but continue the medication, that would, in my opinion, be preferable potentially, but you certainly have to use your judgment. Okay. As I mentioned, breastfeeding with lithium is controversial. At one time, it was contraindicated by the American Academy of Pediatrics. It was revised to a classification of drugs that have been associated with significant effects on some nursing infants and should be given to nursing mothers with caution. That is a mouthful of a title for a class of medications. Toxicity reported in cases with infant serum levels at 0.1 to 0.5 times the maternal level. Recommended to check infant lithium levels at 4 to 5 weeks postpartum and every 8 weeks ongoing during breastfeeding. So if you decide to do that, that's what's recommended. As far as antipsychotics, I've already talked a little bit about this. Atypical antipsychotics with mood stabilizing properties are recommended. First line for depression with mixed features or bipolar depression. And of course, that includes postpartum depression, which is a risk factor for bipolar disorder. I've talked about, there are a number listed here, but I've talked specifically already a couple times about the ones that are FDA approved and lumateperone, the new one that has two positive studies now in bipolar depression. Antipsychotics may have a better risk-benefit ratio compared to some mood stabilizers. I would agree with that. Antipsychotic levels in breast milk have generally been found to be low. The one that I would not breastfeed with for sure is aripiprazole. Okay, now we're moving into the newest treatment that's FDA approved. This is brexanolone. This is an aqueous formulation of the neuroactive steroid allopregnanolone. So this is basically a formulation of naturally occurring allopregnanolone, which acts as a positive allosteric modulator of GABA-A receptors. And so that's its natural job. And if you remember earlier when I showed the GABA-A effects on the HPA axis, you'll see it's a very positive effect when you stimulate GABA-A receptors. So the way brexanolone is administered, and it is again FDA approved now, it's a little bit tricky to give. It's an intravenous infusion. It's a continuous IV infusion over 60 hours. That's 2.5 days. And the doses are 60 micrograms per kilogram or 90 micrograms per kilogram per hour. In this study, the pivotal trial here, you can see it was compared with placebo. And you can see that there were dramatic reductions. The top graph was the Hamilton Depression Score. And the bottom graph is the Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Score, the MADRS. And those effects were seen within 24 hours. And I say within because on the HAM-D score, you can actually see the reductions in less than 12 hours, certainly within an hour or two. Within 2 hours, I believe, was verified. And you can see that within 24 hours, you get most of the benefit, and then it's maintained for up to 7 and even 30 days. Now, the side effects occurring in about 30% of patients included somnolence, dizziness, and sedation, and that's just during the infusion period of the 2.5 days, which can be managed. And this is consistent with GABAergic actions. Now, the exciting development, in my opinion here, is there is now an oral formulation that a company called Sage has developed. Sage makes brexanolone and markets that, but they have a follow-up compound called Sage 217 or zuranolone, which is a pill. It's an oral version. And there was a study called the Robin study that looked at zuranolone for severe PPD in 151 women ages 18 to 45. The results, decrease in the HAM-D seen at day 3, but effects seen at least by day 3, maybe even earlier in some people. And the effects at day 3 were zuranolone dropped the Hamilton Depression score by 12.5 points versus placebo, which was 9.8 points. And that was a significant p-value, as you see there. At day 14, which was the primary endpoint, zuranolone dropped the HAM-D score by almost 18 points versus placebo, 13.6 points, highly significant. And the difference was maintained to the end of the 4-week follow-up period. And the way this is done is it's a 2-week oral administration. So you take it for 2 weeks. At the end of 2 weeks was the primary endpoint, but the effect was maintained even after stopping the medicine for 4 more weeks after that. As far as response rates for zuranolone, very high, 72% versus placebo at 48%. Remission rates were 45% versus only 23% on placebo. For a clinical trial of depression, those are excellent numbers. The Hamilton anxiety and CGI-I were also significantly better for zuranolone. So what we see here, not surprisingly, by stimulating GABA-A receptors, you expect to get an anti-anxiety effect, but you don't necessarily expect an antidepressant effect until you understand the interaction here with the HPA axis. Most common side effects here, which were much less common than with brexanolone, include somnolent sedation, dizziness, upper respiratory infection, and diarrhea. At least somnolent sedation and dizziness can be explained probably by GABAergic effects. But the drug was well tolerated. There were very few dropouts due to those side effects. So those are two of the exciting developments here in the treatment of PPD. And these are non-monoaminergic treatments, which may also be better. And some of these women, as I mentioned, might have unrecognized bipolar disorder. So this may be a safer way to go. As far as other treatments with some limited evidence, we have ECT, we have hormonal therapy such as estrogen patch, bright light therapy, TMS, as I mentioned earlier, was also studied for women with depression during pregnancy, omega-3 fatty acids, folate, and that might include L-methylfolate, SAMe, St. John's wort, exercise, again, one of my favorites, massage, and acupuncture. As far as psychotherapy for prevention of PPD, subthreshold depressive symptoms in women or women with risk factors for PPD should be considered. When I showed you the brexanolone and the zuranolone data, those were for severe PPD. So we're talking now about milder forms. Supportive and psychological care, including home visits and, interestingly, telephone support. In this era of COVID-19, we're all learning about how to do telemedicine, and that was actually found to be a very effective versus standard care, which was educational information booklets, antenatal classes, and routine peripartum care by a primary care provider. Supportive and psychological interventions are more effective when delivered postnatally than antenatally, interestingly. All right, how about detecting postpartum depression? Whose job is it? Well, PPD offers a unique opportunity for prevention and treatment. It occurs within a limited, delineated timeline following a concrete event, so you can really increase your index of suspicion. As far as pediatricians, really, that's probably who has the opportunity here, because pediatric well baby visits may be the only consistent contact with a clinician during the first year postpartum. About 70% of pediatricians, however, never screen for PPD, which is really surprising. The American Academy of Pediatrics, however, does recommend screening for PPD at 1, 2, and 4 month well baby visits. As far as OBGYNs, it's interesting. They tend to have limited contact with new mothers after childbirth. A lot of contact before. About 30% of them never assess for maternal depression either. All right, well, now we've come to the end here. So in summary, when it comes to perinatal depression, women, children, and families are impacted. So the effect is not just on the mother. Effective, safe, accessible, and acceptable treatments are needed, clearly. Treatment considerations involve risk of medication versus the risk of the untreated disorder. So we always talk about risk-benefit with medications, and we talk about the risk of the medication, but we have to remember there's a significant risk of inadequately treated or untreated depression, especially in this period, in the peripartum period. Drastic hormonal changes occurring postpartum in interaction with GABA-A receptors and subsequent modulation of the HPA axis are thought to underlie the pathophysiology of postpartum depression, and the novel allopregnanolone formulation brexanolone may offer a more effective and faster-acting treatment for PPD than traditional antidepressants, and we hold out hope that zuranolone, which I showed you the study that was positive and is probably going to be submitted to the FDA, so it's probably about a year or so away from being potentially being approved and on the market, which is an oral formulation, again, of a GABA-A positive allosteric modulator, also shares the faster acting and more effective and safer treatment. Mm-hmm.